case, please.
Exodus for the second day in a row.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, I'm Steve Emmert, and in this appeal I represent the administrators of the estate of the decedent, the wrongful death claim involving medical malpractice. Since discovery was introduced in Virginia in the 1960s, this court has steadfastly enforced the right of litigants to learn what they are entitled to learn about the opposing party's information in the case. And they take a dim view of the trial courts forbidding discovery on a relevant subject. We know that discovery is broader than admissibility, and under these terms, the court has taken pains when a party has been unfairly deprived of discovery, such as in the Nizan and O'Brien case, to reverse. That's what should happen here. Let me address one topic that clarifies the relief that we're seeking in this case. It's an issue that was raised in some of the defendants' briefs. The defendants chide us for referring to only to policies generally of the hospital, but outlining in detail in brief only two of them. Well, it's quite possible and even likely that there are more relevant policies that were set as a basis for discovery and that were forbidden. The problem is we don't know what they are. The two that we were able to brief, the two that we were able to outline for you here, are the ones that emerged during trial. What the defendants seek to do, I think, is to put me in an untenable and impossible position of being unable to identify policies that they have succeeded in shielding from discovery. So no, I cannot tell you all of the policies that would be relevant to these discovery requests. And yet, what I ask that you do in this case is reverse and direct the trial court to permit discovery of all those policies, not merely the two that we know about simply because they came out at trial.
Before you get there, would you address the question of whether or not there actually is a ruling of the court that had survived the first action and was merged into the second one after non-suit? Because it seems to me that if it didn't, then the arguments you're about to make are no import.
I understand. And the trial court, this court's decision in Dalul versus Agby indicated that decisions made before a non-suit can indeed carry over after a non-suit into the subsequent litigation. More importantly, what the trial court did in this case was enter an order specifically incorporating the previous discovery in the previous case. The date of that order is September 24, 2012, and it's in the appendix. In this instance, the trial court, because of the judicial economy, the significant monetary and time savings to the parties, and efficiency, granted a motion to incorporate all previous discovery in the case. Now, the defendants have taken the position that that's fine as far as just the questions and answers are concerned, but they have insisted that that doesn't include the objections that were made, the briefs that were submitted, the arguments that were made, and the trial court's rulings. I think we pointed out in the reply brief fairly conclusively that that's not the way the parties treated it. The extensive colloquy in the hearing that took place 3 weeks before the second trial indicates that both judge and litigants fully understood that all those rulings had carried forward as well. And as well, we pointed out in our brief that discovery is not merely a set of questions and answers. It's a process. And that's the way it's always been regarded here. So when the trial court incorporated that, it incorporated both the previous objections and the trial court's rulings and the bases for that.
Well, I guess the dilemma that I have, and maybe your answer is sufficient, but it seems to me that parties could craft an order that incorporated some but not all.
I agree.
And they could do that on purpose because they wanted to have, for example, a second shot at the ruling.
I agree.
And so if that's the case, we would look to what the parties memorialized in their order to determine what came forward.
I think that's fair, yes.
Well, if that's the case and what came forward was discovery, I guess what your argument is, that includes all of the rulings on what's not discoverable.
Correct. correct, and the trial judge certainly assumed that, as you've seen from the colloquy that we quoted in our reply brief. The parties agreed. The lawyer for the hospital, for example, said, we've already had a ruling on this. You've already ruled. There's no reason to go through it again. And the judge said, you're right. So if the parties had elected to incorporate only certain things, for example, the interrogatory answers, or even just the questions and answers, they could do that in the scope of an order, but they've used broader language to talk about discovery.
Well, if there had been a motion in limine to exclude the testimony of an expert on the grounds that they did not have a clinical practice in the area within a year of the opinion, would that have come forward?
In that situation, I'm not sure, because the doctor could very well, in between the two cases, have reestablished an act of clinical practice, in which case you have a different set of circumstances. Presumably it would, but I would think that a party would be allowed, in this instance, to seek rehearing of that in order to cure the difference, to point out the difference, I should say, to the court in saying this doctor no longer has that problem. That's my sense of it. It's clear that the parties regarded this entire set of discovery, including the objections, including the briefs, including the rulings, had indeed been carried forth by this order. And I think that the court would make a mistake if it tried to narrow, by a very shallow definition of what discovery is, what the parties themselves carry out in the course of litigation.
Let me follow up and ask you that question from a different perspective. If we agree with you, this case may well be cited for the proposition that if an order is entered like the one you have in this case, then everything carries forward to the new trial. Might not that cause an unsuspecting judge, who's not the same judge that heard the first case, to be unaware of what all had been ordered? Seems like a real trap for a trial judge.
And I think that the best way to address that is to say that where the parties craft and the court enters an order such as this, it remains binding upon the parties unless subsequently amended by another order. And of course, the parties can, as with the example that Mr. Justice Lemons gave us, seek rehearing of an issue where it's no longer binding, where the doctor now has an active clinical practice, for example, and the court has a reason to rehear the case. I'm not asking for a blanket broad ruling that says once an order is entered, it is chiseled in granite, because there can be situations in which circumstances change.
Well, I take it also none of the papers are actually included in this case, were they?
No, I think that they are included in the, when you say the paper.
The trial, I mean the orders that you're talking about now as being included in discovery, because when an order is entered incorporating the discovery, what comes over from the other trial? Anything?
I am confident that the orders denying discovery from the original case are in the appendix, and if you like, while I'm waiting here, I
imagine they're in the appendix, but were they also in this case, 1273, whatever this is?
He's asking if it was in the record of the court, this case.
Of the second trial.
My assumption is that it was, but I'm not certain. I'm not going to stand here and tell you affirmatively that it was. However, the order that was entered in September of 2012 emphatically is in this case, and the transcripts are certainly in the record of this case, because they've been filed.
I know they're in the appendix. My question, as Justice Goodman clarified it, is did the trial judge in the second trial, the 12-73, I think that's the case number, have all that in front of him?
My belief is the answer is yes. When I came to look at the record of this case before filing the briefs, I did see that the transcripts of those matters were indeed, the original hearings were indeed in the record of this case. I don't specifically recall standing here whether the original orders were also in this case, so I can't tell you the answer to that conclusively right now.
Okay.
Let me address one more issue before I sit down, and that's the question of the statutory change in 2011 to Section 801.58.117C. In that, the legislature enumerated a list of 10 items that would be protected from discovery. Those, and it's a very quick list, those include analysis, findings, conclusions, recommendations, the deliberative process of committees, proceedings, minutes, records, reports, and expert opinions and reports. Nowhere in that list will you find policies adopted as a result of this deliberative process. It's clearly geared toward protecting the deliberative and evaluative process that is behind promulgation of these regulations. But once a regulation has been adopted, it's no longer part of this list. My Latin is probably awful, but I think the doctrine is expressio unius est exclusio alterius. The expression of one thing is the exclusion of other things. And if the legislature had intended to include the ultimate policies, they would have listed it here. This is, as you've seen hundreds of times, a request by a litigant to ask you to supply language they perceive is missing from the statute.
Mr. Emmett, I know you're looking for refuge into your rebuttal time, and I'm going to let you get there in a minute. But
I try to guard that jealously.
But there are two questions that I'd like to pose to you and let you at least have a first shot at. One is that there's a controversy, assuming that all these things did come forward into the new case. There's a controversy over the request for the hospital's definition of troponin ranges.
Right.
Now, I have read this fairly carefully, and I've come to the conclusion that that doesn't exist. What they have is the manufacturer of the product's ranges, and that's what they sold you, and they have asserted there is nothing else to give you. If that's the case, what is there for us to decide?
I don't know that this court can determine that on the record that you have before. The trial court has received representations from the hospital's lawyer on two different occasions, giving two different answers, and I don't know.
See, I can't imagine that a hospital would have a separate range than a manufacturer. I mean, it sounds correct to me just on its face, because a separate range is not going to be used to establish a standard of care anyway.
Understood.
And a very careful hospital would probably want to have a different, a more conservative range. Well, why would they want to have a more conservative range that makes them more likely to get sued?
Well,
they don't have a range. All they have is the manufacturer's range, and that's what they said. Aren't you looking for something that doesn't exist?
First, I'm sorry to have interrupted you.
No, that's right.
It is also foreseeable to me that a particular hospital may want to provide more urgent patient care or more meticulous patient care than merely what's required by the manufacturer. So I can't say categorically that's something that would...
Well, I'll let you go. You wanted metadata and information that's electronically stored, and I know why, because what you want to do is you want to find out who was involved in the care. Apparently, they offered to give a witness that could be deposed, that could explain and answer those questions, but that person wasn't deposed. Why isn't that a waiver?
Because the data itself is different from listening to a party talk about what the data would contain. We're entitled to have our own expert take a look at this and say, in our opinion, this expert or this witness who's explaining what they have is giving you an incomplete story, for example. We're entitled to the information, not simply a description of what the information is. And so that's not the same thing.
But didn't the trial attorney agree that they would depose the corporate rep? And so isn't that a waiver?
I'm candidly thinking back on it, I don't remember that there was an agreement by the party, by the attorney, to depose that witness. I'm not sure if that would be a waiver or not, because the lawyer is entitled to make his decision, I think, based upon what the original records would be in any situation. May I have leave to respond at the time remaining?
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Angela Axel, and I am here on behalf of all three defendants in this case. At the trial level, my colleague and I represented the hospital, Mary Washington Hospital, in this case. May it please the court, on behalf of all the defendants in this case, we ask that this court affirm the decision of the trial court below in favor of all three defendants. The plaintiff has presented, even today in oral argument, this as a discovery case involving hospital policies and metadata, a case that that they desire to be a landmark case for this court to decide on. But it's really, as the court has sort of indicated by their questions, it's really a procedural case, and they can't get to those issues of policy and metadata without getting through the matter of whether they've preserved the issue. In this case, the court's well aware, it was first filed in 2010, and during that first case, there was discovery filed. There were two motions to compel on those discovery requests and hearings on those motions, and the court ruled on those motions. Then the case was non-suited in 2012 and brought back again within the time period allowed under the non-suit statute. Because of that, that puts us in a procedural posture where that first case, where all of that discovery engagement occurred, is over. And the courts have actually said that means that case, the non-suited case, has concluded as to all claims and all parties, And even in the Ipsen versus Moxley case, which is cited in our brief, it's as if that case never happened. It's a clean slate.
Was that the understanding of the parties as the second case went forward, though? Would you respond specifically to the colloquy that that Mr. Emmer referred to?
I will, Your Honor, and I'll place it in context, too, for the court. What the counsel is referring to, my first response is, it's our position that you can't concede verbally, just sort of accept without any formal acceptance of everything that happened in a trial before. It has to be formally in an order. Having said that, Your Honor, the context of that conversation was a pretrial hearing in the underlying trial where nothing about discovery was an issue before the court. And because of that, what counsel is citing is a few comments from my colleague out of frustration in that it was being brought up again by the plaintiffs in that case. Never was formally brought up before the court. This was actually motions to exclude in preparing for the underlying trial. So the context of those conversations was a dialogue about Mary Washington Hospital's motion to exclude an expert from the plaintiff, and the suggestion was made during that conversation that the hospital had was hiding a policy, and because of that, out of frustration, they got into a conversation again about discovery and what had happened before. And it sort of gets back to the issue of a non-suit versus the new case. Just by luck, in the new case, we had the same judge, the same attorneys, the same parties. It very well could have happened that this case could have been refiled, and I think one of the justices brought it up, in a different jurisdiction before a different judge, or in a jurisdiction with two different judges, and another judge could have gotten the case. Without some sort of formal order documenting and carrying over the motions and briefs from that previous case to this case, we're binding a new judge to a decision of another judge without any sort of formality to it whatsoever.
I'm having to process it, and I understand your legal argument, but I must say that if your frustrated colleague had answered differently, I think that your opposing side would have acted differently. And you may be right as a matter of law, but it just doesn't feel right in terms of the relationship that attorneys have. And if one says, well, that's already been ruled upon, and the judge says, yeah, that's right, and then the other side says, well, therefore, you know, if it's been ruled on, we're going to move on. It's just...
And that wasn't really the context of the conversation. The conversation came about, it was a pretrial hearing. Well, and at that juncture, it was a pretrial hearing. And were there, if it had raised any question about discovery and whether the discovery issue was still not resolved in some way, shape, or form, or whether discovery had been brought up in that case, the plaintiffs had plenty of opportunities during this new trial to bring that up by motion, by interlocutor. They could have tried an interlocutor appeal.
And that's my point. There. If your colleague had responded differently, I think perhaps they might have.
Well, and I think the understanding, and it wasn't, nobody at any point in time, and you'll notice in the brief and the reply brief, no one has pointed to anywhere where it said, oh, yes, I understand, those decisions are binding on me. The context of the conversation was not, I agree, I've already ruled. The context of the conversation was, by luck, we all have the same parties here. We know what happened before in this case. And it was brought up again almost as dicta during another argument on a motion to exclude. It wasn't even an issue before the court. And it was raised in that sense, and it was kind of, why do we have to go down this road again? Because it's not been raised as an issue before this court.
I don't want to take up too much of your time, so go on with your argument.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to respond to a comment made by regarding the non-suit by counsel in the reply brief and also brought up during argument, and that is the language of the incorporation order, and that's the only order that in any way links anything from the prior case to this case. And the language in the order, as the court's aware, says all discovery conducted and taken in the previous action. And in the reply brief, the appellant suggests that Part 4 of the rules sort of incorporates everything about discovery because Rule 412 talks about motions to compel. And we disagree. In Rule 4:1A, the court actually says, as a rule, one may discover using depositions, interrogatories, requests for production, physical mental exams, and requests for admissions. And it limits discovery to sort of that definition. While not called a definition, it implicitly defines discovery in those realms. And in addition, Part 4 encompasses far more than discovery, as you're very well aware. Part 4 also encompasses pretrial conferences. It also talks about general motions practice and is not limited to just discovery. So the order is pretty clear that only discovery conducted and taken, and that's consistent with Rule 4:1. It will carry over, and the understanding was that motions and orders were not included. I would just add, as far as the non-suit, the issue of preservation, there's no objection anywhere in the trial of this matter to any evidence that was raised. Plaintiff began by arguing that they were denied discovery, therefore couldn't prepare for trial. That was never raised as a motion. But then plaintiff also says, and is alleged in several ways, that these issues that they were denied access to were brought up at trial and used against them, actually by the defense. While we disagree with that, if that were true, an objection would be required to preserve that issue at trial. And there was no objection, not anywhere in the trial, the week-long trial that we had in this case, was there an objection. And I think counsel argued in the reply brief that that wouldn't be appropriate because their position was, we didn't think it was admissible, so why would we object? We thought it was admissible, that's why we wanted it, so why would we object at trial? And our response is, if it were brought up at trial, and it was something that you were denied in discovery, the objection is, Your Honor, I object. The defense can't use that because I was never given that in discovery, and that way it cannot be used against them. And then the court would be allowed to rule on that issue. And it was never raised. Counsel talks about, I believe, Justice brought up the issue of whether the non-suit and anything from the prior case was in the file for this current case. It's not. What's in this current case is a post-verdict motion filed by the plaintiff below. And that was obviously after the verdict, and there are motions for a new trial. And attached to the post-verdict motions, after obviously the jury has deliberated and ruled in this case, are the motions and the transcripts and the orders. So it's not part of the trial, the true trial transcript in the sense that it was brought over from the other case to the current case by any order or otherwise. It was brought into the case and introduced as an exhibit to the post-verdict motions. So the court is absolutely correct that it's not even a part of the trial court's record below. I'll point out to the court, too, the sort of inconsistencies.
Isn't that the interesting distinction? I mean, before you were practicing law, when discovery was requested, it was filed in the clerk's office.
Yes, sir.
And it became a part. I mean, the discovery became a part of the file.
Yes, sir.
The clerks of the world did not like that, and so the rules were changed. So discovery is not filed with the court to begin with. But all those motions and all those rulings are filed with the court, and there's a distinction between the two. So you get an order in the second case that says we incorporate all the discovery is incorporated. Well, it wasn't in the file to begin with. It's out there in the lawyer's files. So the distinction is that you have the very issues that are before this court today are actually located in another file, and the discovery was never in any file.
Yes, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct. I'll also point out for the court, in response to the reply brief from the plaintiff, regarding whether it was preserved at this case below. As we've said, there were no motions to compel, it was never raised as a pretrial issue, never formally presented to the court as an issue that we've been denied discovery or an issue for the court to address, or even the issue that we were not able to prepare for trial. In the plaintiff's reply brief, in the appellant's reply brief, I'm sorry, they, on page 5, they state, the trial court denied the widow's motions to compel after full briefing and argument. And this is a quote, this is the point in the proceedings where the trial court erred. They've identified the error in their reply brief as the error of the court in the prior action. So reference to their post-verdict motions and reference to trial, the error that they've identified occurred in the prior non-suited action, and that's even occurring, even according to their own reply brief.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that there are four people up here that disagree with your view of the non-suit, and let's get into the merits. Is there a document that the hospital has that is responsive to the assignment of error one?
For troponin?
Right.
No, Your Honor, there's not. And it was represented multiple times to the court and to plaintiff's counsel at the time in two different hearings. And the court accepted on the record, having heard from both parties, and even in part of his ruling, said, I accept that the no document exists, that there's nothing else there. And I'll clarify for the court, what they've asked for is not, as you indicated, they had the manufacturer's reference range, which is what they initially asked for troponin. And then they asked for a characterization from Mary Washington Hospital, a characterization from the hospital. So is that normal? Is that high? Is that elevated? Is that low? And that's what they were seeking, was some sort of characterization from Mary Washington Hospital, which doesn't exist, and that was represented to them.
And with regard to the second issue of metadata, Mr. Emmert says, well, yes, there is a witness that was offered up to us, but what we want is the metadata, because we want our own expert to look at it. What do you say about that?
Well, Your Honor, the metadata is a little bit unusual in the sense that the request was actually for all electronic medical records, bills, and other documents. So the words metadata, audit trail, timestamp, those types of things were not used. The trial court at the lower level got into, it was narrowed to, they wanted to know who reviewed the document when, which is the timestamp or audit trail information. And they also wanted to know information about who had about who accessed the menu at the time, and then what were the choices when a physician is coding in any information, what were their choices. The court at the hearing, the only thing that was raised at the hearing on that issue was the coding information. And the court looked at it from, the request is for medical records, electronic medical records. The physician goes into a record and is coding in symptoms. What he doesn't select, he or she doesn't select, is not part of that medical record. And so the court decided because of that it wasn't part of the medical record. As the discussion ensued a little bit more, the offer was made for a corporate designee to sort of explore, what is this what you're looking for? And that was never pursued by plaintiff's counsel, never pursued at all beyond that hearing, beyond plaintiff's counsel. So the court at the initial hearing found that that wasn't part of the medical record and didn't address the issue of the timestamp at the hearing. And then there was never any follow-up to submit. They submitted a new interrogatory that was more specific and said, okay, that's not part of the medical record. Give me the metadata, the timestamp. And that was never asked for, so it wasn't really ruled on by the court, even in the prior proceeding. So for those reasons, because it was never ruled on, and the obligation is on the plaintiff to get a ruling on that issue, and because they didn't follow up on it with a corporate designee, which was an offer for deposition, we believe that they've waived that argument. And I have 4 seconds left. I don't know that I could even start a thought in 4 seconds. Are there any more questions from the court? I appreciate it. Thank you much for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Emmert, may I clear up, when I use the word you, I'm not talking about you personally, because I know you had nothing to do with the trial in this case.
Understood. Thank you. I want to clear up one issue that has been on the court's mind since I got to the lectern, at least, the question of whether these matters are in the record of this case. I've ascertained that they are. These were all attached as exhibits to the plaintiff's post-trial motion for a new trial filed in this case. The new trial motion is at page 114 of the appendix. The motions to compel from the earlier case are at pages 796 and 894. The transcripts are at pages 824 and 1109. And the orders from the trial court in the first case are at pages 836 and 1164. All of these documents were attached as exhibits to the plaintiff's new trial motion in this case, so they're part of the record here. Let me deal with one topic that Ms. Axell mentioned here, the fact that there was no trial objection. She's correctly pointed out our position that the error was made earlier in the case and then, of course, carried forward in the incorporation order. But I want to make sure that the court understands my position. A party is not required, a party might, if they so choose, but is not required to abandon a legal position that has been argued, whether it's in a motion or an objection, at a subsequent part of the case. Our position all along was that these policies were discoverable and indeed admissible. And the reason that there was no objection is because that would have been frivolous. It would have contradicted our earlier position in this case, and we're not required to abandon that. The widow in this case has maintained that position consistently. I appreciate your interest in the issues of this case and your courtesy to me today.
Thank you. Call the next case, please.